Hello, friends. Welcome to the February 2026 issue episode of Courage to Thrive, the show by Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan. And today we are all in for a remarkable treat. David Monteith is the Dean of Canterbury, and he is here to talk about a day in the life of the Canterbury Cathedral. So take it away, Bob.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Bob. Yeah, it's still winter here, but nevertheless, the days are getting slightly longer for us, so spring must be nearly coming.
Yeah, so winter there, the grass is still green, but it's a little chilly in the air and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
as opposed to the snow and ice that's outside my door, and the frigid cold that's braced the east coast of the U.S. So yeah, no, it's we all share winter in our own ways, right?
So I think we got a bit of, we got the remainder of your terrible storm, but it mostly landed in the north of England as snow, but down here in the south of England we just got lots and lots of rain.
Yeah Well, that's the weather. I'm always remarkable how dramatically the weather can change. The climate is different from the north of England to the south of England, where you all can have palm trees that are growing, types of palm trees, whereas not in the north. Yeah, it's quite the difference. So
definitely not in the north.
Yeah. So speaking of which, I wanted to start out by just asking you about your own spiritual journey and what appears to an American to be quite a long but short journey, geographically, but culturally, and it just in its ethos, such a big journey, to be from the north of Ireland to now in the southeast of England at Canterbury Cathedral of all places. So tell me about, kind of how was your spiritual journey, and you would describe it and when it kicked off, and take us through that for a bit.
Sure. Well, I was born in 1968 in Enniskillen in County Fermanagh, which is in Northern Ireland, so it's part of the UK, but right over on the west side, so 100 or so miles west of Belfast, and very near to the Republic of Ireland. And as such, it was known as a border county. You have border states, we had border counties. And therefore, apart from Belfast, it was the other sort of area of the north of Ireland where there was a lot of violence during the Troubles during the 1970s and 80s. And so I grew up with that sort of violence as a background to my life, really, where bombs and shootings and ambushes and all these kinds of things were just so-called normal. And of course, when you're in it and you're a child, that is your kind of normal. You don't really realize that other kids are growing up in a different way than you are.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a Christian home in the Church of Ireland, which is the Anglican version of the Episcopal Church in Ireland.
So let me ask just two quick questions. Part of that is, one is, you say you're a border county, and there are how many counties in Northern Ireland? Because that's important.
So there's six counties in Northern Ireland. So it's quite a small geographic area. Mm-hmm.
And so if you're on the west, you're out by the coast. And what would the border have been like? I mean, as us Americans, we'd think there's a border between us and Canada, and before the border got a big thing here, if you crossed the border, you were supposed to find into Canada, you were supposed to find the Canadian border crossing person. It was very informal. And yet if we cross into Mexico, it was not that way. So how would that feel, just so Americans can get a sense of that?
Yeah, so it was a real marked border. There were checkpoints on the northern and on the southern side of the border. And generally, the southern side of the border was sporadically staffed, but the northern side of the border was actively staffed, particularly by British soldiers.
Okay.
And so there was lots of barbed wire and all of that. Okay. When you want to cross over, you kind of had to queue up in a car and get across and so on. I mean, it's kind of anecdotal, but I think I saw enough of it to know it was true that if you went to the border crossing, and because we were a Protestant family, and Monteith is it would be known as a Protestant name, we'd be quickly waved through. We'd largely be trusted, as it were. Whereas if the car behind us were called Murphy or O'Neill or something like that, a Catholic name, they would be stopped and quizzed more. So it was an unequal way of dealing with the border.
Right.
And also quite a lot of, I suppose, one of the big things that happened particularly, you know, the main checkpoints would be manned and staffed in that way. But of course, you know, a border runs through fields and across rivers and all kinds of things. And there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing late at night, illicitly, where weapons and bombs and ammunition would be going backwards and forwards across the border. And also with that, perhaps terrorists who were operating as well, you know, would be hiding and moving about either place. So it was places of tension and uncertainty. You can now, as I did just a few weeks ago after Christmas when I went back to see my family in Northern Ireland, you know, you can just drive across from the north to the south and the south to the north. The only difference that you really notice, well, you notice two things. One is that the road signs, the traffic speed limits in the north of Ireland are in miles per hour, and in the south of Ireland are in kilometres per hour.
Mm-hmm.
You notice that difference. The other thing, which again is a reversal. So when I was a little boy going from the north to the south, we went from good roads in the north to bad roads in the south.
Right.
You now go from bad roads in the north in the United Kingdom to really good roads in the south, because the south has become much wealthier, much more prosperous. And, you know, the island of Ireland used to export people all the time all around the world, as you well know, on the eastern seaboard, in America and so on. You know, what would Boston be without the Irish? But now it's transformed the other way around. Ireland now accepts people coming to Ireland because it can offer great jobs and great prospects.
Okay, so you could wind up wandering these days, or even then, kind of wandering across the border, you know, through fields, and wind up on one side or the other. So there wasn't a big fence that was there. Okay, so that's kind of a, you know, in our minds, particularly these days, that's something for Americans that would think differently.
No, it didn't look like Mexico or Bethlehem, as it were. Nevertheless, there was a border, nevertheless.
Right. So it's more like what the Canadian border kind of feels like in the U.S. in places, certainly. Mm-hmm. And you were considered, you know, we kind of think of it as Protestant and Catholic families. You know, my Irish roots were Catholic in the Republic of Ireland, but at that point, or different southern counties. But you would have thought, you all would have thought, okay, you're in Protestants as opposed to the Catholics. That's how you would.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a great little joke, which I'll just quickly tell, which just makes the point brilliantly, because everything was seen through that lens.
Yeah.
So there's a story about an English family who moved from the city of Manchester to Belfast. And they are a Sikh family, and the little Sikh boys with their very small little turbans on their head and go out to play football in the street. And the little lads in Belfast say to these wee boys, they say, you know, are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic? Because that's the only question that really matters. And the incomers say, no, we're not a Protestant or a Catholic, we're Sikhs. But then the wee boys in Belfast say, but are you a Protestant Sikh or a Catholic Sikh? Because it's so deep, it was so deeply imbued in people that it was such a fundamental difference, which would kind of always be there, irrespective of many other things held in common.
Wow. So I wonder, in growing up there, you know, that being particularly religious, you know, particularly as Protestant, could, you know, be risky or maybe not, because it ties you in. But there's one thing to be kind of like, I could imagine, you know, I identify as, you know, a Protestant, but then there's a difference of, like, you know, Protestant or like Protestant, like we go to the church all the time. I mean, in other words, how take me from, you know, growing up in this contentious county on the border in the western part of Northern Ireland, and bring in the religious aspect.
Yeah, so I grew up in a Church of Ireland family, and generally speaking, as a kind of gross generalization, Anglican Northern Irish Protestants have tended to be of the more moderate kind.
Okay.
So the vast majority of Protestants in Northern Ireland were Presbyterians, and within that there were then a number of splinter Presbyterian groups, including the group founded by Ian Paisley, who was the leader of the Free Presbyterian Church and the Democratic Unionist Party. So my parents would have brought me up in that kind of moderate unionist kind of way, wanting to continue being part of the United Kingdom, but not condoning terrorist activities.
Okay.
But nevertheless, wanting to maintain a sort of an identity different to a Catholic one. And it comes out of a late 19th century, early 20th century Catholicism in Ireland, which was very controlling and was very in bed with the state, and which kind of forced its Catholic way of life on the whole community. And, you know, my parents would have taught me to respect my Catholic neighbours, you know, that I should never, you know, marry a Catholic or anything like that, but they have their rights and their obligations and so on in society. There should be equality, and that the rule of law should be respected. And because the rule of law still by voting said that Northern Ireland should be part of the United Kingdom, then, you know, that's the kind of values and stuff I was brought up with. And my faith, nearly everybody had a faith affiliation in the days when I was growing up. There were very few people who weren't churchgoers to some degree or other. And so it was only sort of as I got into my teenage years, and particularly at a time when the politics of Northern Ireland were getting very heated. Mrs. Thatcher was the Prime Minister in England, and she was in a big war with the Northern Irish politicians. A lot of the terrorists who were in jail, both Protestant and Catholic terrorists, were also causing a lot of trouble. There was something called the hunger strike, when a number of provisional IRA hunger strikers didn't eat for weeks and weeks and weeks, and eventually some of them died. So tensions grew and grew and grew, and there was more and more violence. And I, like a lot of teenagers of my day, and I guess still teenagers of our day who grew up with a faith background, you know, I did wonder really whether faith was just all part of the problem, and that it would be better to jettison all of that and to find another path in life free of all of that. Because I didn't really, you know, I didn't recognize when I saw a Protestant paramilitary on the television, I didn't recognize anything of the faith of Jesus Christ and what they were saying at all, even though they were appealing to that faith. In the same way that I, you know, watch politicians from around the world claiming affiliation with Jesus at times, and I don't just mean in the States, I mean right across the world, and then watching their actions and thinking, I'm not sure I can see Jesus Christ in that action very easily. I went off to university. So I had a faith. It was real. I went off to university. I wanted to explore it a bit more, but I wasn't sure. You know, I wanted to find my own adult way of being a person. And when I was at university, in my second year at university, there was a big bomb back home in Enniskillen. It took place on Remembrance Sunday, when everybody was gathered in the local town, the cenotaph, laying wreaths to remember the dead from the wars. Mm-hmm. And during that service in the town, a bomb went off. It killed a lot of people and it maimed a lot more. And one of the people who died in that bomb was a woman whose father, Gordon Wilson, forgave the IRA publicly for killing his daughter in that bomb. Mm-hmm. It was an extraordinary thing to do. And Gordon said that he forgave the Mary's death because he followed a savior who taught him to forgive. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, it had a profound effect on me, and it just began a kind of a swivel in my life, which made me think, oh my goodness, this Christian faith is so powerful. It can even address violence and death with a new discourse entirely, and therefore be part of the problem, no longer be part of the problem, but rather be part of the solution. And so I began taking my faith much more seriously from that moment onwards. And then eventually that led to me exploring a path to ordination and priesthood.
So the bomb went off. That was near your hometown or in your hometown?
In my hometown.
So it was in your hometown. And how big was your hometown? I mean, this was...
It's about 30,000 people.
Okay. So you knew people who were affected, and were your family at the remembrance? Or?
No, they weren't that day. They actually were at another remembrance event that was happening. But, you know, I knew a number of the people directly affected. Yeah. And of the others, you know, they were names of people I knew, like the head teacher of a local school and so on. Even though I didn't know them personally, I kind of was aware of them in the community.
Yeah. So that's certainly a very courageous thing for that person, you know, that person to do, and see how courage can inspire others, certainly to reflect on their faith. That's interesting. Yeah.
The more I've learned about that story as well, the more fascinating it is, because I think his wife found it just very difficult in terms of her own grief, and never really was able to say what Gordon said. Mm-hmm. And so I think there were tensions also within the family as a result of him taking this courageous step. And then also the Wilsons, they owned a draper shop in the town that sold, you know, clothing and bedding and things like that. And you know, again, towns like the one I grew up in were quite divided in their loyalties. So not exclusively, but, you know, often Protestants would go to Protestant shops and Catholics mm-hmm. to Catholic shops mm-hmm. and this kind of thing. And a chunk of the Protestant people stopped going to Wilson's shop because they felt that Gordon had betrayed them, mm-hmm. really. So I think it was a very costly thing in multiple ways to that family.
Yeah, remarkable. Hmm. So you become a priest. You follow that path. Why don't we just briefly, as we land in you in Canterbury, briefly kind of summarize your vocational journey, your journey, you know, your work as a priest. Sure. Yeah.
Sure. So I trained as a priest, and my first curacy was in a busy suburb in the city of Birmingham, which is a big sort of sprawling metropolis. But like many English cities, they work in kind of neighborhoods, and I was in one of the neighborhoods. It was a church that was right on the high street and saw itself very much in the heart of the community. And I learned there the value not only of being part of a gathered community, which I belonged to, but also one which had porosity out into that community. So it wasn't just about those who wanted to kind of go to church or be part of the church community, but we ran elders clubs and youth clubs and all these kind of things. And I really loved working in these multifaceted dimensions. And that led me to then go on to work at St Martin in the Fields, which is in the heart of London on Trafalgar Square, just by Nelson's Column. And that's a very famous church, famous for its music, famous for its social care, particularly its work with homelessness people, and famous in that place of interaction between, you know, on the one hand, the real life of the city of Westminster in the heart of London, and the other real life of the city of God and the hope of eternity. There's a famous poem by Francis Thompson, which is entitled Betwixt Heaven and Charing Cross, which is the local station to Trafalgar Square. And so at one moment, I would literally be, you know, preparing a huge public memorial service involving members of the royal family. And then the next minute I'd be running in a taxi with one of our homeless guys who had just fallen down the steps because he'd had rather too much to drink, taking them to the local accident and emergency department. And that taught me working about the value of working with different communities at all ages and stages of the community and all parts of it. And I just got a real love for that kind of diversity, which eventually took me to cathedral ministry, first in Leicester, where I was the Dean of Leicester, and I was the one responsible for reburying King Richard III when they found his bones in a car park in Leicester, which again is not something that you set off as an ordained person thinking that's what you're going to do, but this is the sort of things that happen and you end up having to respond to them. But again, that was a moment where I was trying to bridge the world and the church and make connections between the two. And then I ended up eventually, after a long story, as the Dean of Canterbury, and I've been here for 3 years.
Right. And Canterbury is this large, if those that haven't been there, it's a large structure church in the center of this this university town these days. The universities grew up around Canterbury. That there's the interior part of Canterbury and its grounds that the city has kind of grown around, and there's this enormous tall structure, ancient structure that is Canterbury Cathedral centers the city, grounds the city, and also kind of overshadows the city in some way. So what is it like? You know, what's your work at Canterbury Cathedral? What is that typically like for you? So it's different than Trafalgar Square or other places. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same and different. It's interesting, isn't it? So the Dean of Canterbury is the leader of this community, both the spiritual leader and servant of this community, but also the day-to-day, chief executive's the wrong phrase, but it's, you know, I've got to keep an eye on everything. And I have a big team of staff that work with me, four or five other clergy who are canons in the cathedral, and then a team of about 250 people working in quite different departments. So we have stonemasons, we have medieval glass specialists, we have archivists and librarians, we have musicians, we have folks who run a hotel, we are a major tourist destination, and so we have a whole pile of people who work with visitors, we have gardeners, we have accountants, we have IT, we've got it here. And I chair the governing body of that and try and provide spiritual and strategic leadership to the place. And not only the cathedral itself, but we sit in a walled precinct. The walls date back to Roman times. We have quite a lot of buildings in the precinct itself, and we play host to a school which also looks back to the founding days of the 6th century, dates way back to that time. And then we also own about 80 properties in the town. Some of the rents and revenues from those properties help to hold the place together. And it's a 14 million pounds a year operation, which I guess is about, an $18 million equivalent, something like that.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's not dull.
No. Yeah. So, wow. Yeah. So you certainly are, in a sense, an executive. You're overseeing the strategic vision for the cathedral and guiding that and overseeing the people who run the operations and then the day-to-day work as they execute kind of what your current vision is for the institution and that. So what is, what would be, describe maybe not necessarily exclusively your position or your work, but what would be a day in the life of the cathedral? What kind of typically happens, when the sun rises?
Well, we have quite a steady pattern. There's a sense of stability here, which goes back way to the monastic times before the Reformation. And our day starts with morning prayer at 7:30 each morning, and then the Eucharist, the Holy Communion, at 8 a.m. And then after that, the working day begins to emerge. The tourists are let into the building from 10 o'clock in the morning, and my colleagues are all coming into work. So typically, we'll have then a full day of work, and my day will range from very ordinary operational kinds of meetings to, preparing a sermon, to taking a funeral service of somebody from the community, to doing some radio media work or whatever. And then the day has another significant moment at 5:30 when we have choral evensong most days of the week. That's evening prayer, where we entrust the day that's been to God and we look forward to the night ahead. And then I often will have other things after that. I'll be hosting groups of visitors and pilgrims, or I'll be doing bits of work in the diocese because the dean also serves in the diocese. And then rather beautifully at 9 o'clock or 10 to 9 each evening, the curfew bell in the cathedral rings. And that tells people that if you're in the precincts, you're just about to be locked inside. Mm. And you could be locked inside, but outside, if you see what I mean. Sure. And then we close up the gates like a medieval institution. And we hopefully go to bed and look forward to another day. So that's very typical of most days here. And probably 6 days out of 7, you'll find me here in the cathedral doing that kind of thing.
Sure. So it's a patterned life, as you say, and it's patterned around these what we would call offices, worship services that kind of mark the day to pause and to be intentional, and then of course the ringing of the bells at the end of the day. So there's this kind of rhythm that sets in that, in a sense, is comforting, I would imagine. Other times could be stressful because you've got to stop what you're doing to do what to be community.
Yeah.
And so that could be that, so there's some tension there, but it's a pattern of life that sounds centuries old.
It's centuries old, and I'm grateful that there's a kind of objectivity about it. It's just given, and it's not a question of sort of turning off the alarm in the morning and thinking I've got to be there. I'm mutually accountable to my other colleagues here, and if we are ill or something like that, in a modern way, we now have a little WhatsApp group and we say, look, I've woken up and I'm feeling really rough and I won't be there. Please accept my apologies. And that acknowledges that the whole is missing something, and that we are literally one another's keepers, our brothers and sisters' keepers. You're right that some days it comes as a pure gift and nothing else. Other days it can be very annoying and interrupting. But even when it's annoying and interrupting, I'm grateful for it because it reminds me of why I'm here, what I'm about. And it reminds me that whatever I was just doing on the computer in my office that I thought was the most brilliant paragraph that anybody's ever written, it puts that back into context and reminds me that David Monteith is a human being made by God, sinful, in need of grace, and stop what you're doing and look to God instead of looking to yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sometimes can do more than that, but at very least it does that every day.
Sure. Wow. Okay. So you have this pattern that comes along, and then you have because Canterbury is the ceremonial location of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm-hmm. You go along with your day, and then sometimes the Archbishop is in town. I know that there's a residence there for the Archbishop. And then sometimes you have things like a new Archbishop. And so I would imagine that those kind of events drop in, or when the Archbishop is in town, or when there's a new Archbishop that we have to, that the church has to recognize, that everything that will become stressful, but that pattern can feel interrupted. So we've got a new Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullaly, and so she's officially this week was legally installed as into her office as Archbishop. And then now we have coming up in March the ceremonial institution of the Archbishop. So what's that going to be like?
Well, as you can imagine, planning is underway at pace. We are used to these big occasions here at Canterbury. We can seat 2,000 people in the cathedral, and there's probably about 200,000 people who actually want to come to this. Mm. So it involves everything from, you know, invitations and responses, catering for particular needs of people. Those who will be here will represent the whole of the Anglican Communion, with bishops and primates coming from all over the place. And there'll be a very big ecumenical contingent because Anglicanism is recognized as a significant part of the matrix of Christianity in the world. So we'll have lots of people from Orthodox communities, somebody representing the Roman Catholic faith and all of that. And then we'll also have interfaith representatives. On top of that, because the Church of England is an established church, then our relationships with the state are particularly well described. And so usually that means we'll have members of the royal family here, more than likely the Prime Minister and significant people from Parliament, as well as children from local schools, people from the town, from Canterbury and from the diocese. And so a big gathering of people and a service at the heart of it. It is about placing the Archbishop in two chairs. Firstly, they get placed in the diocesan cathedra. The cathedra is the chair of the bishop, and it's a symbol of their authority, particularly their teaching and pastoring authority. And so the Archbishop of Canterbury is both the bishop of the Diocese of Canterbury, and then there's another chair, which is the chair of Augustine. Augustine was the first Archbishop of Canterbury. And that's the primatial chair. That's the one where they become symbolically an instrument of unity within the Anglican Communion. And the Archdeacon of Canterbury will place the 106th Archbishop in the Diocesan Cathedral. He's one of my colleagues. And then I will place Sarah into the chair of Augustine. And okay. That will be quite a moment because for me, it's not every day you install an Archbishop, but of course, Sarah, in the long history, which begins in 597 in this place, Sarah is the first female Archbishop of Canterbury. And whilst I'm sure Sarah doesn't want that to be the only thing known about her, I'm very conscious, as I was at St. Paul's Cathedral last week when we confirmed her election, just walking down the aisle and seeing the number of people in tears. And of course, some of them will be because they know Sarah personally, but the vast majority, I think, is because at last we now have a woman archbishop, and it feels like another glass ceiling is tinkling down.
That's beautiful. And I would wonder, so from what you're saying, you have, this is a local event, a town event, with the children being there, that people from the community that regularly each Sunday comes and worships at the cathedral, that this is an event for them. And then, but it's also more, it's an international event because of its the linkage of the Anglican Communion, this kind of federation of churches throughout the world that look to the Archbishop of Canterbury as a spiritual leader of the church. And then there's the, as you said, the established church, which would be a completely foreign concept to us Americans, because we, enshrined in our First Amendment is the state will, is not allowed, the government, the American government is not allowed to establish a church, this separation of church and state, which is very, very important and still a very emotionally charged a part of American life. So you have we couldn't imagine having the head of the Senate or the leader of the House of Representatives at a church service for a leader of one of our church, our Episcopal church, or as a personal expression of their faith, but as a national expression of faith. That's something that's so different for us.
And I think it's these sort of moments, this or a coronation or something like that, that we see the difference. I mean, one of the great ironies, and this is a very naive observation, but from somebody who now goes backwards and forwards between the UK and America, is that I often think, particularly in this era, but actually in previous eras as well in the States, that although officially that is such an important thing, that great separation of state and religion in the States, but actually, generally speaking, religion and the state is much closer de facto in America than it is actually here in the UK. We hear much more in America about how, big cohorts of particular faith approaches to things influences the way decisions are made, whereas in the UK that would be a very, very unusual thing. I mean, at the moment there's a piece of legislation going through our parliament which is called the Assisted Dying Bill, and it's about assisted suicide at the end of a life and whether or not that should be legalized. And more than likely, it will pass through Parliament. And you would think that in a country like ours, with such a close affiliation with the Christian faith, that that would be really highly questioned. You know, I know there are good, faithful Christians who think that's a fine thing to do, but the vast majority of Christians would have questions about that, and particularly concerns to protect vulnerable older people and that sort of thing. And yet, you know, it's the bishops in the House of Lords who can speak into these debates do, but then are largely ignored. It doesn't have currency.
Yeah, so it's interesting how we and this is something I talk about often. It'll absolutely land in other podcasts in the future with me. Is that there was this back when Thomas Jefferson became president of the United States? There was a group from Danbury, Connecticut, the Danbury Baptist Association, and they wrote a letter to him, kind of a concern about the relationship between church and state. And it was in that letter that he writes about the wall of separation. And that's become this colloquialism that defines this, you know, kind of what it, we say, well, there's a separation between church and state. And we use it, it's actually kind of backwards used in the US. These days, from what it was originally intended, what the Baptists were concerned is that there would be that the government would pick a church to say, this is our favored church, and we're going to support them, and we're going to have a say over what happens in that church, that it's a church of the country. Like you all have, and the difference, one of the differences is maybe perhaps all clergy, but certainly many of the clergy in the UK are paid as if they are work for the postal service or they're civil servants, right? And in the US, we are paid by our people who attend our churches. You know, that's how that relationship is different on the one hand, and then on the other hand is that or what how this is developed is this sense of that everyone can have a say over what the state does. You know, certainly all the churches therefore try to influence what's happening politically or, you know, or in the common life of Americans. So it's the church can't tell the state can't tell the churches what to do, very limited ways. Certainly, we saw in COVID a stretch of what the state can and can't say to churches on how they can worship, you know, and when and where and what time. But church leaders. All the time, you know, we look at the current protests that had happened in the past few weeks in Minneapolis. There were many faith leaders at those demonstrations, kind of voicing their concern and objection to the government. And so it's a quite a different experience here in the States than the UK.
Yeah, And I'm very familiar with the arguments both ways round. I mean, from somebody who works in this situation, sometimes I do have doors that open into places of power where I can exercise voice, at least informally. But there is this sense of particularly the church still calling our public leaders to account in the name of God and reminding them about where power comes from. And that whilst we are exhorted by St. Paul to obey the authorities, only if we believe that the authorities are doing the will of God. So in many ways, that the freedoms and so on that we now have today are very similar to those you have. But of course, both our nations and churches come out of a particular context. Today is the feast day of King Charles, King and Martyr. And of course, it's exactly, yeah, exactly. Out of all, out, you know, Charles wasn't exactly a perfect king by any means, but yet it was he died, though, with a sense that what he was fulfilling was a divine call. Mm-hmm. And of course, many of the founding fathers in the States were highly influenced by Puritan thinking here, which took one strand of the Reformation and really made a radical separation between the life of faith and the life of society. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're more shaped by a kind of a via media, which tries to walk both those paths, and sometimes for good and sometimes for ill, if truth be told.
Sure. Wow. Okay, we've moved afield. So we were talking about the day that the Archbishop will the ceremony that you'll have at the cathedral. What does that? So once you have, but so we've been a probably almost half of your time as dean, you've been without an Archbishop of Canterbury. So having an archbishop, does this affect your work and the life of the cathedral? And if so, how?
Yeah, well, I mean, just the fun bit of it, first of all. So I discovered when Archbishop Justin resigned that there was an act, I think, made in 1538, which decreed certain powers that if there was no archbishop, they then went to the dean and chapter of Canterbury Cathedral. So I discovered that I had the power to issue faculties for weddings, which are the special legal devices which allow people to get married in certain churches. So that was kind of interesting to discover. The other thing I discovered was that the power to grant Lambeth academic degrees fell to the dean and chapter. Now, I wanted to give out lovely Lambeth doctorates to all my friends, but then I discovered I couldn't do that. But that was a bit of, you know, it's just interesting, isn't it, how suddenly a bit of history from 500 years ago suddenly impacts a life today. So that's the kind of the fun bit of it. I mean, obviously, although there's been no archbishop, the work of the church has continued. So sometimes during this period, we have picked up things which perhaps the archbishop would have done in the past, and I maybe hosted some things here that usually would have been hosted by the archbishop. So there was that sort of daily life change, and this excitement outside. I know you could hear it because there's graduations going on in the cathedral, and lots of happy young people getting their qualifications. But also, when the Archbishop comes to town, they do bring a kind of an entourage. It's a bit like a travelling court in a way, because the work of the Archbishop continues. And right. So various private secretaries and advisors and so on all turn up in Canterbury with the Archbishop so that they can continue to do the work they're doing. Often people will also come and see the Archbishop in Canterbury during the time when they're here, often here for a week at a time when the Archbishop's here, as well as they're sometimes here at weekends when they're having a bit of a quiet weekend. Although the lovely thing about a quiet weekend is you could be in a little village church somewhere in Kent, turn up on a Sunday morning for your normal Sunday service, and suddenly discover it's been taken by the Archbishop of Canterbury because your own priest has gone down sick overnight and the Archbishop is available to take services at a flash. And so that's a lovely bit of the Archbishop's life. It's also good for the Archbishop because it reminds them that at heart their life is that of a priest and a pastor, a minister of the sacraments, a minister of the word, and it really refreshes their souls just to be in an ordinary worshiping community on a Sunday morning. But often the Archbishop will then ask us to, you know, share in the hospitality of people who come to see her and you know, show them around. We do these lovely night pilgrimages in the cathedral, which we'll do for guests. And the Archbishop will share in the daily life of prayer of the place as well. And from time to time, when the Archbishop is tired, weary, worn and sad, as we all get from time to time, you know, the dean will go out and buy some fish and chips from the local fish and chip shop and sit down with the Archbishop and will crack open a bottle of wine or a can of beer and just sort of kick the heels and put the world to rights in a very confidential, private way, which is what an archbishop needs as part of their surrounding support network.
Sure, sure. Great. So one last question. Let's wrap up with this and a question about for you and back, a question about the cathedral. How do you see the cathedral thriving in 2026, you know, and your vision moving forward?
Well, I think having the Archbishop's installation will put Canterbury Cathedral back in people's awareness again, right across the world. So we want to be prepared to welcome more people who come here. I think we also want to use this moment at the beginning of a new Archbishop's tenure to remind ourselves of the bonds of affection across the globe. And that even when, you know, things are sometimes quite strained in the communion over, well, over women's leadership, over human sexuality, over power, over colonialism, over a whole range of things, that even when those things are strained at an official level, this is a place of welcome, of meeting, of stability. And so even when you get different sides of those arguments, which can seem very fractious when you can read them on social media or on the web or whatever, but often here there's a meeting of people. And that's a different thing than the meeting of ideas. And so I hope that during the year ahead, there'll be much more of that. And that will strengthen our sense of belonging one to another. And then finally, I don't think we can underestimate the fact that we now have a woman archbishop. And I've got to know Sarah quite well over the last few weeks, and I'm enjoying that immensely. And she does bring a different way of being and working with her. But also, I think for young women and indeed older women and indeed for men all across the globe, at a time when, you know, in certain places, women's rights are being constricted, the spaces in which women are allowed to operate in are being constricted. Here we have a woman right at the head of this global community, who is there primarily as a servant, as a faithful pastor, as a listener, as an interpreter of the scriptures. And, you know, when you see those big gatherings of world religious leaders, you don't see many women there, you know, and when eventually, no doubt at some point, she goes to meet the Pope, that will be a moment where, and when we suddenly see what Christian leadership can look like in a multitude of expressions.
Yeah. Wow. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. I certainly encourage everyone to, once we get past the past March, to make a stop at Canterbury Cathedral, because it's well worth seeing and well worth experiencing. So thank you for being on Courage to Thrive.
Thank you very much indeed, and I look forward to welcoming people. And if you come and you've sort of come because you've seen this podcast, do come and tell us that, because that's encouraging to us in Canterbury, but I know it'll be encouraging to you, Bob, as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you all to our listeners, our readers, our everything, our watchers, to be part of the Courage to Thrive show. David Monteith, the Dean of Canterbury, it is an honor and pleasure to promote and meet you. We really appreciate what you shared with us today. So check us out, Incandescent Radio, incandescent.tv, Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts. We'll be everywhere. So thank you, Reverend Dr. Bob Flanagan, for this beautiful episode. We'll see you all next month.
All right. Thank you.